Welcome to the Right Take Podcast, news, ideas, and conversations at the intersection of politics and culture, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I will be your host, Mark Tapson. Welcome back to the Right Take Podcast. I am your host, Mark Tapson. Thanks so much for joining me here at the intersection of politics and culture. The Great Reset. We've talked about this before at the Right Take. My guest, author Michael Rechtenwald, came on a while back to talk about his book about the Great Reset. It's an issue that doesn't make the news very often, but it's always developing and moving forward there under the surface of the latest outrages of the daily news. It's something that those of us who care about preserving our freedoms and our prosperity and our humanity and our private property need to pay close attention to and resist with everything we've got. What is the Great Reset? Well, first of all, it's not a conspiracy theory. It's a very real economic vision for the future developed by the globalist elites like Bill Gates and Klaus Schwab of the World Economic Forum, the WEF, and promoted as a response to COVID and to climate change. In a nutshell, it is the seizing of an opportunity, as the globalists like to say, to adjust the imperfections of capitalism and create something called stakeholder capitalism, or what Rechtenwald calls corporate socialism. I'm not going to dive into that real deeply right now, but Rechtenwald describes the goal as capitalism with Chinese characteristics. In other words, a two-tiered economy with profitable monopolies and the state on top, and, surprise, socialism for the masses below. The Great Reset involves a fundamental transformation of the way that we live. And as you would expect, because all utopian visions end up being totalitarian dystopias, it empowers a small, wealthy elite, like Klaus Schwab, to determine what we're allowed to own, how and where we are allowed to live, how many of us are allowed to live, how energy resources are allocated, and so on. You may recall that the World Economic Forum and company tried to sell this vision with the unintentionally terrifying slogan, "You will own nothing and you'll be happy." So, needless to say, the Great Reset is being advanced even as I speak by the European elites behind such globalist organizations as the WEF, the World Health Organization, the UN, and so on, literally every transnational entity, and they're highly motivated by the terrifyingly anti-humanist ideas of philosopher Yuval Harari, a man I consider the most dangerous thinker alive because he is practically worshipped by Klaus Schwab and the rest of the Davos crowd. My guest today at the Right Take is the author of a brand new book on the Great Reset, and he has a unique and, I believe, vital take on how and why to combat the Great Reset. I've known him for a long time, but I haven't caught up with him in quite a few years, so I'm eager for this chance to bring him on and share his insights. So stay tuned. You don't want to miss this conversation. And let me say, as always, please take a moment to subscribe to The Right Take if you haven't already, so you can keep up with the conversations we're having here with important thinkers, writers, pundits, scholars, and storytellers. And if you like what you hear, a positive review would be greatly appreciated. Thank you, and don't touch that dial. My guest today at The Right Take is a film producer, author, activist, and president of the Human Rights Education and Relief Organization, or HERO. The films that he's helped bring to the screen have promoted the rights of women and the unborn. His humanitarian efforts have aided millions in Afghanistan, Nigeria, Ukraine, not to mention pregnancy centers and women's shelters throughout North America. He's got a brand new book called The Great Campaign Against the Great Reset, and we're going to talk about that today and a whole lot more. Jason Jones, welcome to the Right Take Podcast.
Mark, great to be here.
Thanks for taking the time to come on. First, let me ask you about HERO. What is the Human Rights Education and Relief Organization all about?
So I founded it in 2002, and it strikes people as a bit of a strange organization, but I'd been really committed to pro-life and human rights work since I was a young soldier. I joined the military. I dropped out of high school and joined the Army at 17. The day I turned 17, I joined the U.S. Army. I was really committed to promoting the dignity of the human person, protecting the vulnerable from violence, from the child in the womb to the child in Darfur. And after the military, I went to college and grad school, and I was looking for an organization that did this, and there really wasn't an organization that was fighting to protect the child in the womb from the violence of abortion in the United States, fighting to protect the Uyghur in Chinese-occupied East Turkestan, for example, today. And so I thought, I guess I have to found the organization myself. Very simple mission statement. We protect the vulnerable from violence by promoting human dignity and inspiring solidarity. We have several programs. The key programs are Movie to Movement and the Vulnerable People Project. And Movie to Movement produces movies, and it stands alongside other producers and markets films. And the Vulnerable People Project runs, I founded it to really run aggressive influence campaigns for communities facing ethnic cleansing and genocide. But our mission creep led to sort of the main thing that we do, which is really serving communities in the midst of genocide. We're the only organization still Western organization operating across. I say we're the only organization not on the terror watch list that operates across every province in Afghanistan. We're in Iraq, Nigeria, Malawi, India, Philippines. So that's what we do at the Vulnerable People Project. And that's really most of my work is VPP. We make movies. I write. I have a podcast as well, The Jason Jones Show. But most of my life and time is spent serving vulnerable ethnic and religious minorities. And at the heart of our work the past 3 years has been serving Christians and other minorities in Afghanistan since the U.S. withdrawal, and serving the widows and orphans of our Afghan allies who were killed in action.
Excellent. Okay, well, before we get to your book, let's talk about the film production side of things. I know you produced the powerful pro-life film called Bella, and also the controversial film The Stoning of Soraya M., which is based on a true story and written and directed by our mutual friend, Cyrus Narasta. Cyrus has actually been a guest on this podcast. How did you get involved in producing films? Why is it so important for conservatives to dive into the arena of storytelling and filmmaking, which we neglected for too long?
Yeah, storytelling is at the heart of everything we do at Hero, even in VPP. You know, it's I read a letter when I was in grad school, right after finishing my undergrad. I read a letter, an open letter to the conservative movement by Paul Weyrich, the founder of the Heritage Foundation and the founder of Free Congress, and really one of the five founders of the modern American conservative movement. And in this letter, he said, you know, I've spent my whole life working in politics, and we've won. Most of the governors are Republican. We put the Goldwater Republican Ronald Reagan into the White House twice, you know, and we have most of the state houses, but we're losing on every major important battle. And that's because we've lost the culture war. And so reading that, and I was chief of staff for a state representative at the time, and I was really preparing to go to law school. And two things, I had lawyers that worked for me as I was a young man, but I was chief of staff and under me were lawyers. They hated their jobs. I asked them about law school. They hated law school. So that wasn't appealing to me. And so Paul Weyrich's letter really convinced me that if I want to spend my life, I knew what I wanted to do. I wanted to order my life to serve the vulnerable. And I thought, okay, being a lawyer is kind of makes a lot of sense, right? Harnessing the power of law to serve the vulnerable. But I realized, okay, no, I'd rather make movies. I'd rather write. I'd rather tell stories. And I made my first film, The Gates of Hell. We infiltrated. I dressed up as an MTV VJ in the late 90s, and we would go to rock festivals around the country. And we sort of detailed the depravity of youth culture and the breakdown of youth culture. And so that was my first film, The Gates of Hell, was a documentary. And then I started working on film marketing, had the privilege of having a very small role marketing The Passion of the Christ to college campuses is what I did on The Passion. And there I met Steve McAvity, the producer of The Passion of the Christ and Braveheart. And then ended up meeting the three amigos, the team, Eduardo Verástegui, Alejandro Monteverdi, and Leo Severino. I met them in Mexico when they had this new little film that they were trying to make and get to the big screen called Bella. I was at a meeting with some very wealthy, influential folks. All of them passed. And I said, you know what, guys, I think I can help you. And I leveraged every relationship I ever had to raise them the money they needed. And then I went on to run Sam Brownback's campaign for president. I was his national grassroots director. And they called me and they said, why are you on IMDb as our executive producer? I said, I don't know. I didn't do that. And they're like, I don't know. And they're like, well, we put it up there, dummy. I'm like, why would you say I'm your executive producer? Like, well, you raised all the money. You're the executive producer. You raised the money for the P&A. I said, why would you give me an executive producer credit just for raising you the money? Like, I didn't know. I didn't understand, really. You know, I was making these small, independent, little goofy films. And that was it. And then I met Steve, got to know Steve, actually. And he invited me to be the associate producer on The Stoning of Saraya M, which I think is one of the most important, powerful, and beautiful films in Hollywood history. And I'm really privileged that I got to play a small role as associate producer on that film. It was a great privilege.
As a producer, what kinds of stories do you look to tell? And how, also, how does one avoid doing what the left is often guilty of? And that's heavy-handed political messaging. How can conservatives avoid that?
I think it's simple. I love when people come to me and they say, I love your films, Jason, because I mean, I know you make films that like you're trying to promote pro-life or whatever, but you're not a propagandist. And I snicker and I go, that's because I'm a great propagandist. what you do, and the left can do this well sometimes. I think of films like, the boxing film with Clint Eastwood that promoted assisted suicide.
Yes, the $1 million.
$1 million baby. You know, what you do is you don't twist a story. You don't put a commercial in the middle of a story. You take a story and you tell a true story, or you write a fictional story that's grounded in a truthful, realistic experience. And so I think October Baby, although I'm vehemently opposed to assisted suicide, it kind of gives you a scenario and a situation that's not a commercial, but that would authentically generate empathy for assisted suicide. I think our movie Bella, it's not heavy-handed at all. It just tells a story that even like Rosie O'Donnell calls it her favorite film. Tony Bennett gave it his biggest art award for the year it came out, and he was a left, you know, he was, I think, a socialist pro-choice guy. So, you know, my whole mission to defend the child wound from the violence of abortion was, my inciting incident was when my high school girlfriend was forced by her father to have an abortion, a third trimester abortion while I was away at basic training. But imagine if my high school girlfriend was sexually abused by her stepfather, and she asked me to take her to get an abortion. I may be a pro-abortion activist today. And if I were to make a movie to promote abortion, it would be a story maybe about a young man whose girlfriend's raped by her stepfather, and they run away from home and he takes her to get an abortion. So there's, you know, the left, if they were a little more thoughtful and creative, they could tell stories that generated empathy for their point of view that weren't so ham-fisted and lazy. But I think what we see, just because of their dominance in the industry, is it's just bad propaganda. You're like, this isn't good at all. Like, you know, so yeah, that's just tell stories that are true or that are ring true. Don't twist facts. Don't put in, I call them commercials. I'll go, oh, here we go. Here's a commercial.
Well, I could talk to you for a long time about filmmaking and storytelling, but let's not neglect your brand new book, The Great Campaign Against the Great Reset. As you point out in your introduction to the book, there is no shortage of books now about the danger of the Great Reset, but yours begins by talking about what you call the adventure of love, and you focus on Eros, piety, and posterity. Can you explain how you connect those and why they are important to resisting the Great Reset?
Yeah, I want to go back to films for 1 second while answering this question. You asked me what kind of films I like to make. You know, for most of my career, I wanted to make films that exemplified the incomparable dignity and beauty of the human person. But I think for the rest of my career, I really want to focus on Eros, or the beauty of erotic love between a man and a woman. And when you look at fundamentally what the Great Reset is seeking to do, it's to wipe away the understanding of the human person that entered the world first through the Jews and then sort of more fully and completely through Christianity. So what our founding fathers saw as self-evident, when they said in the Declaration of Independence, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, it was only self-evident to them because they lived in a society and a culture that that it was accepted that everyone was made in the image and likeness of God and had an incomparable dignity, beauty, and worth. Even atheists today sort of have the self-esteem of a Christian in the sense that, you know, when I was an atheist, I was an Ayn Rand objectivist until my late 20s. And, you know, when I was on college campus, I was a little snarky and, you know how it is in college, the little Christian kid would come up to me and go, Jesus loves you. God loves you. And my canned response was, if there's a God, I bet he loves me. I'm lovable. I can't imagine he'd be very fond of you. Like, that was my response, right? And it's true. As an atheist, I was pretty full of myself. I thought I had all of this dignity. It was reading Freud's Sartre and Nietzsche that really obliterated that confidence as a young Randian and made me look to revealed religious truth as maybe the source of my understanding of human dignity, and it led me to becoming a Christian. So what the Great Reset seeks to wipe away is Christian anthropology. And so fundamentally, the vocation of the Christian is to love God and to love their neighbor. And so I write an introduction to young Americans where I say the path to defeating the Great Reset for you, and I go through pretty heavy theology and philosophy throughout the book, but the introduction to young Americans, it's the path is actually very simple, but not easy. Love God, love your neighbor, love your parents, honor them. Preserve your moral imagination. And that's the challenge, right? From pornography, from promiscuity. It's a challenge. Preserve it so that you can experience erotic love, romantic love, fall in love, get married, have children, love your spouse, love your children together with your spouse and the family that you knit together with your spouse. Order your family to serving your community and loving your community, protecting your children, and planting those olive trees for our posterity. When we do that, each and every one of us, where we are, the Great Reset will break against us because it's a war over anthropology. It's a war over the understanding of the human person. And that's what this battle's about.
God at the center of our resistance to the Great Reset. What do you say to people who have knee-jerk concerns that bringing God into this discussion has overtones of theocracy or the boogeyman of Christian nationalism?
Yeah, you know, a lot of people are going to be upset at me for saying this. I do not like a lot of Christians, and a lot of people on the right are trying to like own Christian nationalism and make it a good thing. I'm a Christian. The nation state has utility, and it's prudent to support the nation state today in our world order. My next book is actually against Christian nationalism and integralism. So I think there is, we should be afraid of illiberal ideologies that also seek to wipe away the proper understanding of the human person. I always say the devil's the judo master. So I'm not saying that those fears, there's not, I would say it's like if you're like in your house and you have a storm shelter in your backyard and a hurricane's coming and it's a torrential storm and you're like, you know, I'm afraid to run to the storm shelter because I might get wet. I mean, in the level of threats that we're facing, the rise of Christian nationalism might be like getting wet as you're running to the storm shelter, and the Great Reset is the hurricane or tornado barreling down on your house. So not to say that there's not, I do fear the rise of hateful, illiberal ideologies on the right. And that is just a natural response of young people who have been battled and battered and assaulted and violated by the illiberal ideologies from the left. So I actually have come to really understand, I used to be really like the Groypers and sort of the alt-right crowd. I was very hostile to I didn't understand it, and I was angry. I didn't get where these kids were coming from. But now I've thanks to some of my friends, I have one friend who's a Black conservative leader who I call him the Groyper Whisperer, and he's really helped me try to understand where this is coming from and how these young people have been abused. And that's actually, it was them in mind. It was actually the young children, the young people who are tempted to illiberal, rightist, right-wing ideologies, I want them to put Eros and love at the foundation of their thinking, because a lot of their frustration comes from being battered by porn, being unable to experience romantic love, this app dating. I mean, this is the most sexless generation since before the birth control pill, believe it or not. They have the most partners and the least amount of sex. They don't really know how to experience Eros the way we did, because before puberty, they've already seen pornography that you couldn't, you know, you wouldn't be able to find anywhere in any dark alley in America in 1994. They've seen before they've hit puberty. When it comes to dating, young men are often very angry because there's this huge incel community. 10% of the men on these dating apps are sleeping with 80% of the women. And so it's a very sick thing. And so they're very angry. And at the heart of their anger is Eros. So that might not be the answer you're expecting, but I think it is an authentic concern. But you cannot throw the baby out with the bathwater. The source of our civilization is the Christian understanding of the human person. You cannot save the humane and beautiful things. When I was a Randian, I went through a phase. I kind of fallen in love with Leo Strauss when I was coming out of my Randian phase. And so I kind of went through this sort of, I remember thinking it's prudent that although I'm not going to assent to the truths of Christianity, I'm going to publicly support and defend Christianity. And then I thought that's disingenuous and I should just be a nihilist. If it's not true, why don't I just move to Costa Rica and live above a bar and sleep with as many women as I can and drink as much as I can until I die? And I said, I need to, human beings are incomparable. I wrote my conversion story for National Review. It was called Finding God in the Mirror. And what I mean by that is and that's why I loved Ayn Rand. She did such a good job of communicating sort of the dignity and grandeur and beauty of the human being, of the human person. I couldn't escape the profound beauty and dignity of the human person. And so that drove me to really take revealed religious truth seriously and investigate it. So we cannot preserve the humane and beautiful things without assenting to the truth of the human person that we can only really find supported in Jewish scripture and Christian scripture and Christian teaching.
In the book, you write that we have to begin fighting back against what you call the five ideologies of evil that have infected the minds and souls of some of the most influential people in the world, namely these globalist elites, the Davos crowd, you know, with their really totalitarian vision for the future. And those five ideologies of evil are victimism, Gnosticism, transhumanism, anti-humanism, and climate cultism. Is there one of those that really stands out to you as the most concerning or dire threat? Because I find transhumanism to be the scariest one.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question. I think the sort of the linchpin of all, you know, of the ideologies of evil that we're facing, if you think of the Great Reset as a swamp, sort of the base of the swamp is victimism. And my real goal is, I said to my wife, she's like, what is your goal with this book? I'm like, my goal is to put Rene Girard's definition of victimism in the dictionary. She's like, oh, small goal. That's my goal. What is victimism? The term was coined by Rene Girard in the 1990s. Victimism is the ideology of concern for the vulnerable to acquire wealth, power, and prestige. What victimism does is it abandons the truly vulnerable while empowering those who have abandoned the vulnerable, all in the name of the vulnerable. And I'll give you one example, the border. There is a beautiful new ad campaign that's been launched by Catholic Vote. It's called Defend the Vulnerable, Secure the Border. The advocates of chaos at the border, they advocate for chaos at the border in the name of concern for migrants. But the truth is that securing the first person to the community that benefits most from securing the border are those migrants who are being lured into an underground economy, a dangerous underground economy, where they have no legal protections for exploitation. Who else is vulnerable? Our children, who are dropping dead every 11 seconds from fentanyl. the poorest Americans, who are often immigrants, legal immigrants from the same countries the migrants who are being lured into the underground economy come from. So their wages are being undercut. So to truly protect the vulnerable is to advocate for a secure border, is to advocate for an easy-to-use mandatory verification system where business owners are culpable, held liable if they hire illegal immigrants. So victimism, you can think of another example would be green energy, the quote-unquote green energy. I call it black and brown energy because it's brown children and black coal. You know, if you're driving an electric vehicle, you need to know that you're driving the worst thing for the environment in your town is your Tesla. It's toxic. It pollutes. Its tires are so much more horrible for the air than any emissions coming out of my pickup truck. But that's not even the real problem. The real problem is that electric vehicles created this unbelievable demand for cobalt. Every electric vehicle in the world has cobalt from Congo that is mined by hand by children as young as six who work covered in sores, who get cancers and horrible ailments, and then die. And yet the person, you know, someone listening right now who's like, hey, I drive my EV because I care about my posterity and the environment, as you've said to do, I believe you, but you've been lied to by victimists who are getting very wealthy and powerful, who want to control movement, who want to control the global energy supply. In fact, in one of the most quoted excerpts from Klaus Schwab is we need to fundamentally change energy distribution. Yeah, we get it. We get it. We know that's what you want to fundamentally do. So you don't want America to be energy independent. You want us in electric vehicles so you know where we go and you can control how far we go. The fact is that it's destroying the environment in Africa and in South America with the lithium and the cobalt. And it's the most inhumane industry in the world. Maybe rivaled only by the CCP slave labor camps where they have 3 million Uyghurs who actually are putting together solar panels. So you have Uyghur slaves putting together solar panels, working till their organs are harvested. All in the name of, as King Charles said in his Christmas address, he said, we should not let war and poverty distract us from what we should really be focused on, having compassion for the climate, whatever that means, but it's the perfect exemplification of what victimism is.
To counteract these ideologies of evil that you write about, you also identify five core moral principles that make a free, prosperous society possible. I don't want to give away too many spoilers about your book, but is there one of these moral principles that you think stands above the others that we should be embracing?
I do, and I think that's personalism, but we talked a lot about that. I would like to say subsidiarity. The World Health Organization right now is pushing, because the first lockdowns worked so well, you know, they created the largest famine in the world since World War II. They worked so well that the WHO now is seeking to have the power to shut down the global economy and lock you in your house. And not just you, everyone in North Korea, everyone in Brazil, everyone in Congo, everyone in Guam. An unelected bureaucracy led by an Ethiopian who is a criminal linked to tyrants wants the power to tell your mayor to shut down your town and arrest you if you want to play baseball on a Sunday in a park with your kid. Subsidiarity, this fundamental principle of the West, is that the further an institution is away from you, the less influence it should have over you. And that we should have flourishing free institutions in civil society between you and distant governments. So religious communities, ethnic communities, civic communities, the family fundamentally, first and foremost, neighborhoods, cities, townships, counties, they should all have more, be bumping into you more than the WHO. But if you think it's absurd that your county officials can lock you in your house, how much more absurd should it be that the WHO, led by an Ethiopian doctor, can lock everyone on earth in their house? So we need to be aggressive in fighting for subsidiarity And in Louisiana right now, they just passed a bill making it illegal for the state and county and city officials to obey the dictates of international governing bodies. We need to see this happen all across the country. Subsidiarity alone would protect us from the globalist schemes. But just like Stalin, just like Hitler, just like all tyrants, just like Mao, the first thing they need to do is obliterate every institution between them and you. And at the end of the day, with trans ideology, they want to separate you from your parents. They want to separate you from your friends, from your neighbors. They want to divide us, to conquer us, to leave us as individuals alone.
For those people who feel daunted, Jason, by this uphill battle that we're facing to reclaim the culture, how can they view this task that is lying before us with hope and courage?
It's an adventure. It's an adventure. And it's we should see it as I call it, the adventure of Eros. What a great adventure. Every generation has challenges. I think we've thrown ourselves a bit of a pity party. You know, in the past 100 years, we had the Holocaust, the Holodomor in Ukraine. We've had world wars. We've had genocide after genocide after genocide. You know, we've had it pretty good here, but a lot of our ancestors didn't, and that's why they came here. My wife's family fled from Mao, and they suffered horribly. My grandfather fought in World War II in Korea. I was an infantryman, and my son fought against ISIS in Iraq and Syria. There are challenges. We have our challenges. Our great-grandparents were immigrants. They had horrible challenges, and they had childhood illnesses striking down every fourth kid of theirs dead. Every generation has challenges, and we have our challenges. You know, I was the first American arrested leading an anti-COVID lockdown on day one of the first lockdown. I remember at the time as I was being arrested, I had a big smile on my face. I was on the cover of Drudge Report in handcuffs with a smile. Well, people are like, why are you smiling? I was thinking, God, thank you. Because I was being handcuffed by my former student where I taught him 25 years earlier when I was a Catholic school teacher. He was in my ethics class. And in my ethics class, we would watch Sound of Music. And I used to tell my students, don't be Rolf. Here I was being handcuffed by a kid who I told, don't be Rolf. And I remember thinking, God, you are letting me experience in a little way the horrors of these mimetic contagions. But it's like going to war, but with Nerf guns. And so if we want to compare what we're going through to what others have gone through, they're very serious. And trust me, I was in Ukraine this year. This summer, I'll be in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Nigeria, and Congo. I was in Iraq during the war with ISIS. I see real horror up close and personal. We haven't faced that yet. Our posterity will, full stop. That's why we have to take it very serious, but we shouldn't throw ourselves a pity party. And we should look at it as an adventure. And we should honor our ancestors by sacrificing as much as they did for us. We should be willing to sacrifice as much for our posterity.
Well said. And I think that's a great note to end on. Jason Jones, thank you for coming on The Right Take. Keep up the great work.
Thank you, brother.
Listeners, I highly recommend Jason Jones's book, The Great Campaign Against the Great Reset. It is an inspiring, passionate book. It's not an academic slog through philosophy and economics behind the Great Reset. I think it's just what we need to stand against those who would impose the Great Reset upon us. And thank you for joining me here at the intersection of politics and culture. Don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take so you can keep up with all the important conversations we're having here. And again, if you like what you hear, please leave that positive review. Be seeing you. The Right Take with Mark Tapson is a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center and Front Page Magazine. Unauthorized reproduction of this podcast without express written consent is prohibited.